Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The city of Sioux City is considering a new ordinance aimed at cracking down on human trafficking. On Monday, the Sioux City Council unanimously approved the first reading of an ordinance designed to fight prostitution, human trafficking, and drug dealing. The proposal comes after the state legislature's law that now allows cities to regulate massage businesses. Under the ordinance, businesses would be required to submit identification and information on their employees for background checks. Sioux City could withhold licenses if any agent of the business, owner, or employee had a criminal conviction for a sex crime or for keeping a house of prostitution. The city could prosecute the violations as a misdemeanor. Several local massage therapists say the proposed regulations wouldn't affect business, but others pointed to provisions in the ordinance, like a ban on business from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., as measures that could interfere with their services. Bernadette Rixner is the co-chair of the Siouxland Coalition on Human Trafficking. She says a few things need to be clarified about the proposed ordinance.
There seems to be the assumption that the police can do more than they can right now. If the police go in and someone has a license, that's all they can do. They have no, I mean, they can talk to them and ask them, you know, what's going on and so on. But if a person doesn't want to talk, they can't. If you have this proposed ordinance, the police can go in and they can verify that all the information is current. One of the things it requires is that you list all the people who are employed and, you know, that they have a background check for them and all that kind of thing. That gives them a really good tool for going in and seeing who's there and seeing if they are the people that they said they were and see if they are licensed. What we would like to do with this ordinance is give the police as many tools in their toolbox as possible. There was an instance where someone was licensed and they're not convinced that it wasn't a fake license. Okay. So they're working with the legitimate massage people to check on this to see, you know, how that can be. If they go into a place and they don't have a license, all they can do is report it to the state licensing. All they can do is go in, and if they're licensed, they can talk to people, but if people don't want to talk to them, they don't have to. If they go in and find out that somebody isn't licensed, all they can do, they can't do anything about that. All they can do is inform the state licensing bureau. So if they had this ordinance, they could go in and they could check on who's there, if they're licensed, if they have all the background information on them, and so on. So it gives them another opportunity to be in there and to see what's going on, and to make sure that everything's on the up and up. And the other thing is that I think maybe we're also talking about a much broader picture in terms of human trafficking, with an international aspect to it, of people being trafficked, smuggled into the United States, trafficked within the United States. And again, we need as many tools as we can. Checking on who owners are, if the city has a statement that so-and-so is the owner of this business, and so-and-so is the manager, and they can check on this and track it back. They may be able to find out maybe not who the actual owner is, but this is not the legitimate owner, so that they can pursue that further.
I know there were several owners of massage therapy businesses at the meeting last night who were concerned that this ordinance would cut into their business.
You mean in terms of the hours?
Yes.
Yes. There was a good reason for putting those hours in there. Most businesses have regular hours, but I respect the people who said that they will help somebody no matter what time. I think things like that can be tweaked. There was concern about the amount of insurance, although I think some people indicated maybe that they already carry that amount of insurance. Again, it would be a helpful deterrent for people who weren't in the business legitimately, but if people who are find that that's oppressive, you know, it can be tweaked, and I appreciate it. I thought there was a very good exchange and a lot of really good points brought up last night. I just think that maybe people weren't aware of how limited the police are currently, and you know, that all those legitimate people don't have anything to be concerned about. They can fill out those forms and the background checks and all that. They have background checks done all the time because they are legitimate. So I don't think that it in any way would hurt them. Also, I think that the more we can support the people who are doing a really good job, you know, well, it's the people who are, you know, just running the things and under the radar that we want to try to get in there and get them on the radar.
So, in effect, if this ordinance were approved, then could police basically show up at a massage place of business at any time and look around and, you know, investigate?
I think that's my understanding. I think the other thing, too, is that there were some people who were advertising, you know, on Backpage as massage businesses that really they weren't legit and they didn't have licenses and so on. And, again, if the police went in there, all they could do was say, oh, you don't have a license, or report it to the state. So it's about deterrence, too. If you have somebody who just thinks, hey, you know what, I can do that, I can make some money. They may not even be thinking about trafficking or, you know, selling sex or selling people to provide sex. If they have to go through all these background checks and if they have to, you know, identify all these people and so on, it may deter them from doing it.
I know that the owners of the massage therapy businesses were also worried about the possible insurance effects of this on them.
There's a requirement for, and I don't remember exactly which it was. One was required to carry $2 million and the other was $6 million. I think some of them indicated that was high, although I think I heard someone indicate that they pay that. They have that much coverage already. And that's one of the things, again, that the reason it was set high was to deter people, but if it's going to, you know, injure the local businesses, then that's fine. We can revise that.
What I thought was interesting, one of the owners said that she understands why people are concerned about the possible, you know, fronting for traffickers at a would-be massage therapy business. But she said, well, shouldn't this be handled at a higher level, on the state level, and handling the root of the problem? However, it does seem like states, Iowa, Nebraska, the states, I think, have really been trying to crack down on human trafficking in the past year or so.
Well, and I think in Iowa, the Department of Public Safety is looking at this on a much larger scale, too. But they need the information from the local law enforcement. They couldn't just come in and you know, I mean, it would be as useless for a state patrolman to come in and say, oh, you've got a license, you're okay, which is all the police could do right now, as it would for the local police. So, yes, there are efforts at the state level, and there are efforts at the national level, too, but they're not geared to the massage parlor in Sioux City. You know, they're trying to find some of the people who are more organized in doing the trafficking, and everybody has to put their little piece in to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
The lady understood that, and she also said that some of this is very ugly, and it is. So, you know, we're very aware of that, and the nature of human trafficking is very violent and, you know, very ugly. And that's what we want to, that's what we're looking for. We're not looking for people who, not looking to make any problem for people who are doing, you know, legitimate massage businesses. We're looking for the people who are selling other people, who are using, you know, trafficking them for both labor and sex, and especially people who are bringing people in just for this purpose.
Mm.
So
Yeah, no, I totally get it.
No, I think I think the attitude last night was that we need to work together, and I didn't have the impression, that's a negative way of saying it. I had the impression that the people from the massage therapist were as open as we are to working together to come up with something. They did indicate that they didn't think that this would work, but I'm not sure that they understand what all we would like it to do. So I don't share that opinion. I think that there is something to be gained from this. It may not be monumental, but it's an inroad, and as I said, it's a tool for, you know, for the police.
That was Bernadette Rixner, the co-chair of the Siouxland Coalition on Human Trafficking. Sioux City officials have agreed to work with local massage therapists to finalize the drafted regulation and gather feedback on it. The council will receive edits to the ordinance before the second reading. That won't happen until after Thanksgiving. Some local massage therapists have signed a petition opposing those regulations on their businesses. The change.org petition is called Respectfully Object to Implementing Massage Therapy Business Licenses in Sioux City. It was started by Danielle Calhoun Fisher, the owner of Studio 83 Holistic Wellness. She says that putting new regulations on massage therapy businesses is singling them out and discriminating against the profession. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Sioux City Public Library has a new leader. Helen Rigdon took up her post recently as the director of the system, which includes three branches, a $3 million operating budget, and more than 210,000 physical books and recordings. She succeeds Betsy Thompson, who retired in August, after 22 years as director and a total of 35 years spent within the library system. Rigdon comes to Sioux City from Wichita, Kansas. She says she grew up a country girl who just loved going to the library.
And I grew up on a dairy farm, and my mom would take us to the library once a week in town when she went grocery shopping, and that's where I started loving books and libraries.
And where did you go to school?
I went to school in Coffeyville, Phil Kinley High School, and then my undergraduate degree is from Friends University in Wichita. And then, of course, my Master's of Library Science is from Emporia State in Kansas.
So you've been a librarian for quite some time.
I kind of came into it late. Since I got my degree in 2003, so a while. I had my children and had got them well on the way being raised, and so then I decided to go back to school.
Now, were you a school librarian or just a general librarian?
No, I kind of started out at the college before I went back for my degree at the community college in town and worked at night in the library. I was the evening supervisor, and that really made me start investigating being a librarian. And then once I got my degree, I came back to the community college as an academic librarian. I was the director of the library there for a few years. And then had moved away. My mom got sick, and I went back to Coffeyville as the director of the public library, and that's when I made the switch.
In that job in the public library, what were the things that you were especially interested in working on?
In the public library, it's you have people from all walks of life. You have little kids, you have adults, you have senior citizens, you have teens. So it covers the spectrum, I guess, if you want to say. Where in the academic, yeah, we had traditional and then non-trad students, but we didn't really have any little kids or any story times or anything like that. So I think that idea of serving everyone is what really drew me to public libraries.
Here in the Sioux City Public Library, we have so many different programs, programs for little kids, for adults, book readings, book clubs. What are the issues or the areas you're especially focused on, or are you just really kind of taking it all on at once because you just started?
Yeah, I'm kind of getting my feet wet and, you know, learning the ins and outs. I came at a very busy time. It's budget time, and so I'm trying to get my head wrapped around that and how Iowa does it a little bit different from where I've been in the past as far as money and things like that. But I think the main thing for Sioux City Public Library or any public library is making sure that our patrons and the community knows what we do. A lot of people will go, well, I didn't know the public library did that or offered that. And so I think it's just getting our name out there and making sure that the people know that we're kind of a place of community, that they can come in, they can have a seat, they can read the newspapers. I am impressed that the public library here, we have such an extensive newspaper collection that they subscribe to daily. So, you know, plus magazines and books and DVDs. So, you know, there's just something for everyone.
I know that a lot of people, a lot of younger people have been using the library, probably older people too now, to go in. You can get a DVD. You can take it home for a few days and watch it and bring it back. You don't have to pay to rent it. Don't have to go to the Red Box. Will that continue?
Yes. Right now, our collection's not as big as I think I'd like it to be. We will investigate maybe adding some TV series and some other kind of movies. But, oh, yeah, that's, you know, part of our mission statement is both the educational and recreational needs for our community. So, and that addresses that recreational need. Plus, you know, we also have educational videos, documentaries, things like that.
You have a big section for children there. I know that.
Yes, then we have a very nice children's section on our main floor as you first come in the doors. And they have a little puppet theater. They have computers for the children to use that have educational programs on them. We, you know, of course, have books. We have story times. We do craft programs. And then we also have something right now called 1,000 Books Before Kindergarten, which is a nationwide literacy program. And it's trying to get parents to read to their children and promote that literacy that's so important, because we all know that children, if they, you know, are read to, their vocabulary is greatly increased as they get into third grade, by third grade level. So we have that, and the children, once they read 200 books, they can come in and sign up, and then we have prizes as they move forward, and they get a certificate and a medal when they finish 1,000 books. So. Yeah. It's fun. We have, I think we've got 12 young people that's finished it. So that's a lot of books.
It is a lot of books. I was going to ask you about the services where you can download things. You can download and read a book, say, on your phone, on your iPad. Is that going to continue? Will it expand? I'm just assuming it will continue.
Yes. You know, when e-books, electronic books, first became popular, there was a lot of, I don't know, scuttle that, you know, the regular books were going to go away. But we're finding that's not true. I think it's going to be a hybrid model, kind of. We have both. Because there are people that prefer to read it on their Kindle or their mobile device. And but then there's people like me. I still prefer the actual book. But when I travel, I want it on my laptop or my tablet, just because then I can bring as many books with me as I want. But the library, with your library card, you can download ebooks and have them for, depending on the book, and it's set by our vendor, not ours, but it's 2 weeks, I believe, 2 or 3 weeks. And you don't have to worry about any overdues. You don't have to worry about any fines or losing it. And it just is returned automatically at the end of your period. It's kind of sad, though, sometimes if you're still reading it, so then you might have to go back in and try and check it out again. But we also then have audiobooks that are available to download. I love those. I can download them to my phone, and then, you know, when I'm traveling, I can listen to those. We have found that even our physical audiobooks that we have that are on CD have been checked out enormously. The circulation is increasing enormously. The popularity of them as people realize they can do two things and still read a book.
I used to listen to a lot of the DVDs, come take out like the big book, like the Game of Thrones books, DVDs, all of those. And it would be like, this is great. Every time I got in the car, and it was kind of a car thing for me then, because I thought, you know, this way I just have this time to myself and to do this. Now I do more sort of on my phone, you know, download and all that. But I really, those are a great resource.
They are. I think people sometimes don't think about it. And, you know, if they have a long car trip, or even just, you know, if they have a daily commute, maybe of 20 minutes or something, you can listen to a book. But I also find that I like to do it, like if I'm doing housework, which isn't my favorite thing to do, but it makes it go by faster. Or if I'm cooking, or, you know, doing anything, you know, you can, or even taking a walk, you can, those are nice if you like have it on your phone and use headphones. And that's a great way to, you know, read a book.
At the library, usually when I go in, I see at least a few people sort of in the area where the magazines are reading, and, you know, they look like they might be homeless or at least have nowhere to go. How much of an issue is that for the library, you know, dealing with that and providing them with services, but yet making everyone comfortable?
Yeah, that's kind of a ongoing issue. And as a public library, we are open to all people, and whether they're homeless or not. And so we do encourage them to come in. It's warm. It's a safe place. But they also have to understand and follow our code of conduct that we expect, because we want it safe for all of the patrons. And that includes, you know, people with children and single people. So, you know, I mean, we have some incidents that happen. We do have some, the library gets some off-duty police officers that come in at different times and work for us, and they usually will help us if we have any incidents. I mean, and they're not horrible incidents, you know. It may be someone's just backtalked, they've used bad language, and I mean, and usually they're, you know, they're not in the children's area or anything, but it's just a matter of life. And I think it's a sad reflection on our society now that we do have these homeless people. But, you know, like I said, we do welcome them into the public library as long as, you know, they follow the rules. And, you know, there's things for them to read, and there's the computers to use. And so, yeah, we do have cards that they can get if they're in a temporary shelter and use our services.
And you are living, you say, downtown.
I am.
So
I am.
Probably not too far from the library, right?
I'm not. It's like a 3-minute drive. It's a great commute.
So how do you like it?
I love it. I love it. You know, when I came up for my interview, I really didn't know too much about Sioux City. And so, you know, I had done some research online. And, you know, people, you know, I was living in Wichita before this, and that's a town or city of about 350,000. And they're like, Sioux City. But it's a nice town. I like the size of it. I like the people. Everybody has been so friendly and so nice and so welcoming. The former director left a great staff and a wonderful library for me to inherit. So I was thankful that I got chosen for the job. But yeah, I moved into one, I guess they call it the Hopper Building. It's there in Virginia Square, and they're great. I love it. And I have great big floor-to-ceiling windows in my living room and bedroom, and it's lots of fun, and it's close to the library and all the action downtown. I just encourage everyone to come into the library, see what we offer. We, you know, also have music CDs if people are interested in that as well. We do have a service. They can download music, 5 free downloads a week, with your library card. And so, you know, you can kind of build your own collection that way. And it has a lot of, and I can't remember the exact number of something like 3 million or something, different songs and then artists and stuff. But so, yeah, I just encourage you to come to the library, check us out. That's kind of a library pun, you know, check us out. But just stop in and see everything that we have to offer. And we welcome you. And, you know, you always can just stop in and say hi.
That was the director of the Sioux City Public Library System, Helen Rigdon. She took over that position October 9th after the resignation of longtime director Betsy Thompson. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Soul Searching, Seeking Faith and Spirituality in Siouxland, is a new segment with Molly and Ryan Dowell-Baum. Through it, they seek to introduce Siouxlanders to the diversity of faith and spirituality and discover the many ways that faith and spirituality are a force for good in Siouxland and beyond. Ryan and Molly are a clergy couple who have called Sioux City home since 2013. Molly is a musical theater artist by training, a Presbyterian minister by ordination, and she and Ryan have two small children. Ryan is the pastor of the First Congregational United Church of Christ. Their guest today is Jackie Paulson. Jackie is a licensed mental health counselor, a certified facilitator, and registered 500-hour yoga instructor as well. She's the owner of B Studio, located in downtown Sioux City, where she teaches yoga and offers holistic counseling. Her hope is to build space and to empower experiences that awaken the creative and sacred force within others.
Jackie, what is yoga? Is it prayer? Is it exercise? Is it something else? Is it all of the above?
I see really anything that helps bring you into further integration within your being as yoga. A lot of times when people start coming to yoga or even begin yoga teacher training, I'll ask them, you know, how many of you feel like you, how many of you have practiced yoga before? And if you're in a room full of beginners, all of them will be like, well, no, you know, I haven't. That's why I'm here. But then we begin exploring the definition of mindfulness in yoga and what that means. And they'll find that their parenting is yoga, their jobs, their washing the dishes or spending time in nature, that this is their church, their own spirituality or religious beliefs really are a practice of yoga, even if it doesn't look like the traditional Eastern practice of yoga.
Tell me more about the origins of yoga. You mentioned it's different, maybe how we practice it or come to know it in the West. I understand that it starts in ancient India.
So in India, as well as it has roots in Pakistan and many other areas in the East, and I'm thinking about this chart that I often use when I'm doing workshops or trainings on the history and lineage of yoga, and it really does branch from not only Hinduism, but Jainism and Buddhism. We can go back to the Upanishads, which is a very ancient scripture,
writings or texts of scripture.
Right, that really we see the three blend through the Upanishads, and then they kind of split up from there. The principles, if you look at them, are going to be, the root of the principles are going to be very similar, the way in which they're practiced, and specifically what is seen as more of a priority to practice will start to differentiate the three. There's another text called the Yoga Sutras, and this is when it was written by the author Patanjali. It was really designed to be a poetic expression of the scripture of yoga. Okay, so almost like a hymnal, if you would think of like a psalms in the Bible. It's really meant to be a poetic expression. So it's made up of four different chapters of many different verses that delineates how should we practice yoga or what is yoga, basically. And in fact, that's the first question of the first verse of the first chapter is what is yoga?
What is yoga?
And through the verses, especially in the first chapter, he goes through over and over, how do we calm the vacillations of the mind? Yoga is there to help us with that. Yoga in the way of breath, in the way of freeing tension in the body, yoga in the way of philosophy, you know, the yamas, the niyamas, which are like ethical guidelines or ways to live your life through your relationships with self and others. Then there's one verse in particular that I really love to highlight in regards to the first chapter of the first verse when he talks about what is yoga. Yoga as a way to calm the vacillations of the mind so that we can connect more deeply with the spirit within us and around us, to study and be further devoted to the religion of your choice. Patanjali actually asserts that yoga is not about one religion in particular. Mm. It is about strengthening the faith in which you feel called to practice, which I love. And what I find oftentimes as a yoga teacher in observing people experience this practice is that no matter what their faith is they're coming into, it strengthens their belief in that faith. And my experience, even in my own upbringing with Wisconsin Synod Lutheran, so it was a pretty strict Lutheran upbringing in that church. And when my mother died, I had a big kind of spiritual crisis in regards to my religion. And I really was questioning my relationship with God. And it really wasn't until I started practicing yoga that it strengthened my relationship with who I saw as Jesus, God, Mother Mary, the saints. But ultimately what I found is that the practice has helped reestablish my relationship with who I was introduced to as God as a child. And oftentimes if people open their hearts to it, I find that our students feel that same reemergence of connection with their higher power, even if there's no name for it.
I think that's really good to hear, because I suspect that sometimes there's a suspicion or there's this worry that yoga is not, you can't do it properly, that's either it's misappropriating a religion or that it's then I'm worshiping something accidentally, or that I'm being Hindu when I'm a committed Christian or something. And this idea that it is, it sounds like it's okay and it's even meant to be used and practiced to support, like you said, whatever your religion is.
Exactly. And if we come back to that original definition of yoga, to yoke or to unite, it is ultimately to bring people closer together, and to bring people closer together to whether it's a relationship in their personal life with themselves or with a higher power or with all of life. It's ultimately meant to help us feel whole.
And we really need that today and always. So, Jackie, how do you see your role as a yoga teacher in the spiritual life of the wider community?
My intention as a yoga teacher for the wider community is very similar to my intention even as a mental health therapist and as a studio owner. And it's really about creating space for people to have a place to reconnect with themselves that is unbiased, open, and supportive. So when I teach, you know, again, in the West, a lot of what we teach is the asana, but even in my classes, it's always the asana, the postures are always driven through a heart intention. So the class is brought in through mindfulness, through connecting deeper into your body, your breath, and then further into some sort of whisperings of the heart or connecting something, so that when you leave your mat and go into your life, the practice can really serve and benefit you in that way. I believe we have so much weighing on us throughout our lives. We have lots of pressure, lots of expectations, so many things in life that are speaking to our subconscious that we are just operating from, whether it's marketing or TV or, you know, lots of different things. So if people can just come back to a place of quiet and be invited to listen deeply into what's really within themselves, that sacred body wisdom, that sacred heart wisdom, I believe people will feel more open and free in their path and in their life, and hopefully that will extend out. So really, it's so simple. It's just about creating space, literal space being the yoga studio, the time and place of the class, but then further inviting them to create space within themselves to not feel so much tension, contraction and restriction, but to feel expansion and freedom and movement.
Yeah, we really need that space in the busyness and the freneticness and the riskiness of the world. If we don't have space and time to slow down and take stock and reconnect with ourselves, it can seem bleak, it can seem hopeless. And it sounds like this nurturing opening of space, inviting, is all part and parcel of sort of cultivating wholeness in individuals and in the wider community.
Completely. And I believe that in regards to the macrocosm of life being our universe, our world, our nation, our cities, our families, that all of that begins within ourselves. So to give people the opportunity to go to the origin point and begin to heal and find wholeness within themselves, that, I mean, for me, that is like my contribution to expanding and healing the entire world.
Well, that's powerful and beautiful work, Jackie. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that and for being with me today.
Yes, you're so welcome. Thank you so much.
At a time like this, words are inadequate. The most eloquent tribute would be a reverent silence. Yet in this decisive hour, when world events are moving so rapidly, our silence might be misunderstood and might give comfort to our enemies.
Franklin Roosevelt, the longest-serving president in United States history, is dead. World War II wages on, and a farmer and former senator from Missouri becomes the commander-in-chief. Harry S. Truman learns of a new, experimental weapon that could end the war, and now he has to make a decision to use it after being president for only 118 days. This is the story of The Truman Decision, an original play written and directed by Adam Goncharowski. Adam, thanks for joining me.
Yes, thank you.
And we also have Greg Giles with us, who plays the president.
Hello. Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
So The Truman Decision is part of the new American Playwright series at Shot in the Dark Productions. And the series focuses on developing and producing works by living American playwrights about the American experience. And we have our living American playwright right here.
Yes, I still have a pulse, so I guess I still count, right?
He's alive. He's alive.
So, I mean, you know, looking at The Truman Decision, what does that mean to you? You know, how does this specific story fit into the broader narrative of an American experience?
Well, if you look at it, that's is the one event that has shaped the future from that point forward. You know, you're looking at all the arms races in the world, and then all of a sudden you can trace it all the way back to, you know, 1945, 1939, when they started the project. So it is a clearly defining moment of probably most living people's lives at the moment.
It shapes geopolitics to this day. All you have to do is witness what potentially could be going on with North Korea and with Iran and with other countries who are jonesing for atomic weapons. It's, you know, you forget about it. As just day-to-day living, you don't think about nuclear existentialism or the lack thereof of what life would be like if we had a nuclear war, all-out nuclear war. And then when you're actually thinking about it, which is what the play is about, the decision to whether to drop it not once, but twice, because the Japanese didn't capitulate after the first detonation in Hiroshima. And then you think about what that would look like on a wider scale, and why how scary the Cuban Missile Crisis was in 1962, or how scary and precipitous the Cold War was for the, you know, 1949 to 1989, the 40 years of the Cold War. It's really scary. And I don't know if you watch, but about a month and a half ago, YouTube, for whatever reason, the defense world released to the entire world every A-bomb and H-bomb test video of, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. You could watch them, like, wow, that's really scary. These things are just awesome in their power. And let's never have that happen again.
Yeah, so, I mean, now it's so much of we're just living in that reality. We're not really thinking back of, mm-hmm. of that first decision.
Right.
So, you know, what drew you to Truman?
That he was just an ordinary Midwest guy, like, thrown into this situation. To really...
The accidental president, completely accidental. The backstory, if you know, the FDR served, four terms, was elected four times, and 12 years into his term. And prior to this term, his third term, he had, from Iowa, Henry Wallace was his vice president. And there were a significant hue and cry within the Democratic Party, the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. They didn't want what was perceived to be a very liberal, and a lot of other reasons, they didn't want Wallace to potentially succeed FDR. So, as a sop to a bunch of different elements of the Democratic Party, Truman was chosen for the fourth inauguration. And so literally this two-term senator from Missouri, last president we had who was not a college graduate, high school graduate, not an accomplished high school student particularly, graduated from, school with no amazing marks, but an amazing American story. And I think he's a pretty cool character. And Adam's done a really nice job of writing this quintessentially American person.
Yeah. And Harry Truman was like the first guy that was like, oh, anybody can be president.
Literally anyone can be. Not from the landed gentry, not from the Ivy League, just a regular guy from Independence, Missouri.
So the Truman decision is set during World War II in 1945. What have been some of the challenges of writing and producing a period piece like this?
Well, the first big hurdle for us to get over, like, mentally was realizing that they were coming from a place that didn't know about the bomb. Like, we all
FDR
know,
knew about it. We knew about it. And FDR knew about it, the Manhattan Project. We have to go in.
Yeah, just go in.
As though this is all new information. Because that's the amazing thing about the story, is that when Truman took over in April of 45, he had no idea that there's been this project going on for 3 years. He didn't know what the Manhattan. He'd never heard of an atomic bomb before. It was completely new information to him. So for us who've grown up in the duck and cover era, getting that revivifying your naive brain to the point of pre-grade school, not knowing what alliteration is, not alliteration, but obliteration.
But yeah, just getting back to that moment of realizing that, oh, hey, this bomb exists. We don't know what it's going to do. And then on top of that was finding costume pieces and sort of building the Oval Office was a huge...
It's very cool. Adam, by the way, not only is the producer and the writer and the director, he's also the set designer and the lighting designer and the sound designer. He is the jack of all trades. And the set is a reasonable facsimile of the Oval Office. I encourage you to come see it.
Yes, yeah, so we did some amazing work on the set, and thank you to everyone who worked on it, touched it. I mean, there was quite an army there at the end helping us get it put together. And then the other challenge was Greg's glasses we had to find to match Truman's, because it's a very particular style of eyeglasses that he had to wear.
Round specs. And so he shopped around on the interwebs, but then ultimately found them in an antique shop, right? So they're genuine antique specs.
Okay,
that are
I was going to say,
round,
where did you find them?
Little round metal glasses. So
this play runs through December 9, but in the meantime, Adam, you're also turning the Truman decision into a feature film. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, the opportunity was there for me. Because I went to film school, and I got my degree in screenwriting, and that's where my writing sort of stems from for all this. So having a set there, having actors, having access to all the equipment I need to do it, I figured, let's go for it, see if we can actually make this work. And on top of that, it allows us to have something pretty substantial coming out of the American Playwright Series to show, so hopefully future playwrights when they come in saying, like, this is what we've done before, this is the level we're trying to produce at, come be a part of our series. So it also gives it sort of that archival quality of having something tangible come out of it instead of just 12 performances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was going to be my next question of, what will you do with the film?
yeah, we hope to, well, see what happens. If it turns out really well, we'll probably try to get into some bigger film festivals and all that. But hopefully just use it as archival and show people what the power of the American Playwright Series and what we can do with it.
With the American Playwright Series, going forward, if somebody wants to submit a script, what's the process? What are you looking for in a production?
Really anything about the American experience and what it means to be an American sort of past, present, and future. So that is a pretty wide net.
I think you do want the playwright to be alive.
Yes,
yes, living, must be alive.
Must be a living playwright.
Yeah, but it must be a living playwright.
Not produced previously.
Not produced previously, so this has to be written specifically for the American Playwright Series, or this is the first time it's been produced.
Produced. But it's not specific to, you know, I think we alluded to this, we were talking about this in rehearsal not too long ago, about how the American experience is a smorgasbord, so you could have a Mexican-American playwright writing about the Latino experience, or, you know, the Bohemian experience for people from Hungary and the Czech Republic, emigres who are, or Bosnians who've come here recently. People, the great diaspora of the American experience of all the people who, you know, come into the salad bowl or mixing bowl or melting pot, they're all American stories.
Yeah, even the Godfather's a great
exactly.
Italian-American story.
Yeah, completely, yeah.
Just a whole wealth of American stories.
As they used to say, there's 8 million stories in the Naked City. Well, there's 330 million stories in the American experience, and the American Playwright Series is up for all of them.
And then, you know, like with something like this, you know, it's original. You're not tied into doing this play a certain way. And I imagine it's kind of evolving and changing a little bit as you're working it through rehearsals and production.
There are, archivally, we have things. Obviously, there's certain things that are 100% verbatim, like the oath of office or addresses he gives to the American people, radio addresses. So obviously that...
Gives, yeah, there's certain historical elements
you have to include
kept
that are,
in,
right.
Certain quotes from right. The various historical figures that are in it that we've...
Regrettably, we don't have in. If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. That is not included in the play, but the buck stops here is included in the play.
So. In a roundabout kind of way. We allude to it.
And, right.
But I don't think the kitchen line came up until like the second term.
That's true. That is true. That is very true. But it's sort of a famous aphorism that Truman quoted. Yeah. So if you've seen Give 'Em Hell, Harry with James Whitmore or the Gary Sinise TV or HBO version, I mean, there's stuff out there you can see. And he was the first president to have a widespread use of in the early days of TV. So he did have TV press conferences and radio addresses. And there's a lot of stuff you can see of him. So for verisimilitude, I'm trying to give a suggestion of it, but it's not a spot on.
Well, we're not doing a
impersonation. Impersonation.
Okay.
It's a drama. So
yeah,
like I said, I think it was one of the first rehearsals. Like, think of it more like a painting rather than a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interpretation.
I've been talking to Adam Gontrowski and Greg Giles. The Truman Decision has select showtimes at Shot in the Dark Productions through Saturday, December 9. We'll leave you with one last interpretation of Truman. This is Harry Truman by Chicago. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.